Middle Passage by Matthew Warner, Part 2 of 2. Captain LeBlanc summoned Poirot to his cabin later that day. Scratching his mosquito bites, Poirot gawked at the large hammock, at the ceiling high enough for him to stand under without crouching, and at the portal through which the sun shone. The captain slept here? 13 slaves lived in such space. During his time in King Kyros's court, Poirot had seen traders carrying some of these other objects. The brass compass, which pointed the way to France, and the colorful chart upon the wall, covered with serpent images and lines radiating from fixed points. These markings charted paths across the great waters. In Poirot's childhood village, the griot had taught that evil traveled in straight lines like these. At last Poirot understood. Another chart covered the captain's desk, which he had situated between them. LeBlanc drummed his fingers upon it, crossed his legs, and leaned back in his chair. He nodded to the sailor who had escorted Poirot.
"Dismissed."
When they were alone, LeBlanc said,
"So, you were disturbed by what happened this morning?"
"Oui."
"As was I. There's too much death on these voyages. Not just you Africans, but good sailors as well. I've lost fully half my crew."
Not caring how many Frenchmen had died, Poirot kept quiet.
"These slaves are to blame for their own despair. I make my efforts, give them to eat. I do them respond with willpower. Gratitude? No. They turn me their passage into a living and dying hell."
Seeing Poirot's confusion, the captain said,
"Middle passage. It is the second leg of my journey."
When Poirot shook his head that he still didn't understand, LeBlanc took out a piece of stationery and dipped a quill pen in his inkwell. He drew a large triangle, then pointed at the top corner.
"This is France. I load my ship with brandy, miwa, pewter tankers, yellow beads."
With a grimy finger, he traced the triangle down to the right corner.
"This is West Africa. I trade my cargo to the Africans for the criminals and prisoners of war."
Now moving along the bottom, LeBlanc said,
"This is the middle part across the Atlantic Ocean, the Middle Passage."
At the triangle's left corner, he said,
"Here are the West India and Americas. I trade you for tobacco and cotton."
The finger returned to the triangle's top.
"Back home, I sell my cargo for a profit."
Poirot stared at the paper, his mind sluggishly taking this in. Fever chills had crept into his sides, making it difficult to think. When he didn't respond, LeBlanc slumped in his chair.
"Ah, it's no use. You Africans have no understanding of sophisticated commerce."
Poirot thought King Kyros would have disagreed.
"Look," the captain said, "why do you think I've taken the time to explain this? You're different from the others. Not only do you speak long Francais, but you're reliable, hard-working. I need you to help me down there during this last stretch of the passage. Be my eyes and my ears."
LeBlanc stepped around the desk and pressed the leather handle of the cat-o'-nine-tails on Poirot's hand.
"I'll give you more time on deck. You can watch the horizon all day to keep yourself from seasickness. You like that? All I need is for you to tell me what..."
Poirot threw the whip down into the floor. "I will not be the snake of the forest." Teeth baring, the captain hulked over him. Certainly LeBlanc stayed well fed.
"I've always treated you fairly. Well, no longer."
He returned to his side of the desk.
"Hansen!"
The sailor who had escorted Poirot opened the door.
"Throw the sleigh back into the hold. And Poirot..."
Poirot looked back to him.
"Tell that slave he said to come see me."
It wasn't until Poirot was below deck again and the wall of tribesmen had climbed up that he remembered Issei did not speak French. Who would translate for the captain now that Poirot was his enemy? And the answer came to him like the stench that crawled back into his nose. The captain had a backup translator in another hold. Samitta. The other slaves, listless, hardly looked up as Poro climbed over them. Shouting some at his name, he pulled empty water barrels away from the bulkhead. "Hey," they said as barrels toppled onto them. Poro beat the wooden barrier and yelled until he was hoarse. He didn't have the strength to do it for long. Besides, Sameta was probably on her way to the captain's hold at that moment to translate for Issei. And what would he have told her? Hide? The captain had found her long ago. The day passed in hopelessness. Then that night, as he listened to the groans of the dying, Poro heard a tap. It came from the bulkhead, separating him from the children's hold. Nobody except Poro, slumped against the wall, heard it. Tap, tap. Pause. Tap, tap. Poro thumped the wall in response. Tap, tappity, tap, came the answer. Tap, tap. Poro smiled as he recognized the code. Sameta, the king's star translator, had learned well when her father taught her the language of the talking drums. She had then surpassed him, as she always did. The king's percussionists had actually used slit drums made from hollowed-out tree trunks to transmit messages across the kingdom. Such rhythms defined whole communities, mixing with tribal blacksmiths' hammers to set the pulse of life. They conversed into the night, speaking in the metaphors of the drum's code. From this, and from playing snatches of tribal rhythms they both recognized, Poro learned that his daughter was well. Missed him. Sameta even joked. She made him laugh when she imitated the captain's heavy limp pacing the deck. But when she tapped her motif for captain again, and followed it with the code for herself, and then the ancient rhythms for war, the fertility goddess, and the coming of spring, Poro sobered. Then he doubled over. The captain had raped his daughter, and she was pregnant. The next day, Poro's nausea alternated with the cramp of starvation. Comparing his severe headache with the heaviness of his heart, he wondered if his sickness were physical or spiritual. He decided it was both. With 20 of his shipmates, Poro climbed to the deck. He almost didn't make it up the ladder, so weak was he with fatigue and fever. How would he stay standing for the weekly exercise they were now going to?
"Come on now, look lovely!"
a sailor yelled in French to the group already on deck, as if they could understand. They'd hung a tarp between the masts in anticipation of the darkening clouds that clotted the sky. Beneath it, slaves milled about in sullen pairs, their hands on each other's shoulders while they made slow, exaggerated steps supposed to be dancing. A crewman played le violon, a raucous white man's instrument Poro thought quite useless for the activity.
"I said move!"
One slave was standing still. The sailor, snorting in disgust, whipped him hard with the cat-o'-nine-tails. Poro wondered if it was the very same weapon Captain LeBlanc had offered him last night. He had noted with satisfaction that Issei had later turned without it, apparently also refusing to be deputized. As Poro's group took the floor, the surgeon he'd met at Gore Island bathed the wounded slave's cuts with water and vinegar, then rubbed them with gunpowder. This was at about the time Captain LeBlanc arrived with an ensign carrying his chair and footstool. Poro tensed with hatred. Sitting down and appearing bored with the proceedings, LeBlanc said to the surgeon,
"Don't bother."
The surgeon looked at the captain in surprise before setting the slave on his way. Poro also thought it was strange. Or could dead slaves still be traded for tobacco and cotton? When LeBlanc saw Poro staring at him, he said something to the ensign, who hurried off. Poro looked back to his feet. Minutes later, the ensign returned with Sameta. Father and daughter rushed into each other's arms. The whip be damned, Poro thought, but the lash never came. He looked questioningly at the captain, but LeBlanc just smiled and gestured for them to dance. He hates me, Poro thought, like a cat teasing its prey. Poro held his daughter close. Her appearance had changed, not so much from his grandchild growing inside her. She wasn't even showing yet. But from the weeks at sea. Like the others whom Poro tried not to notice every day, Sameta's tiny cheeks had sunk from poor nutrition. Her hair had grown back since the surgeon shaved it at Gore, and Poro vainly picked off the lice crawling through her scalp. "Are you well?" he asked, knowing she wasn't. "Did he hurt you when..." He couldn't finish the question.
"I live, Father."
A sob clogged his throat. He was about to apologize for causing their enslavement when Sameta said,
"He means to kill all of us, Father."
"No, no, my flower. We're money to him.
But I heard him say so one night in his cabin."
Forgetting his grief for the moment, Poro glanced worriedly at the captain. He led Semeta deeper into the dancing throng, and the Vuolong continued its screeching.
"He thought I was asleep," Semeta whispered. "He stood outside his door and spoke to an officer. The flux has swept through the women's hold, and now a fever illness..."
She cut off as Poro circled them away from the sailor's suspicious gaze.
"And now a fever illness attacks us," she continued. "The captain said we're too sick to fetch a good price in the West Indies, but if enough of us die, then a wealthy French tribe will pay him money for the loss."
Semeta used a term he'd never heard before, contrat de silence, to describe the arrangement.
"They discussed the best way to murder us."
For the first time since leaving Africa, Poro felt a chill that wasn't fever-related. He caught a glimpse of Captain LeBlanc with his bad leg propped on the footstool. LeBlanc's slouch said it all. These slave exercises were pointless, but necessary for appearances. As the next slave group arrived, the sailor roughly separated Poro and Semeta.
"You two have had enough dancing. Return to the slave decks."
"Father!" Semeta's face cracked with sorrow.
Poro lunged forward and hugged his daughter before they were pulled apart.
"I love you, Semeta."
That night, waves and wind tortured the ship's hull as the slaves argued within. Tense bodies pressing around them, Issei squared off against Poro.
"Your daughter is the victim of a practical joke, just like that boy about the whites eating us."
"You saw for yourself what the captain thinks of jokes," Poro said.
"A wealthy tribe that pays you for losing property? Ridiculous!"
"I've heard the captain discuss money. He's not given to fancy." Issei crossed his arms.
"I cannot believe that human beings would treat us so hideously." "A human being built this floating shit pot. A human being calling himself our king sold us for a handful of yellow beads." "Your king, maybe. My king didn't kidnap other Africans and enslave them." Issei's voice shook. "My king didn't march them to the ocean and shoot if they moved too slowly."
Poro turned away. "That only proves my point about people."
"Just because you've lain with evil doesn't empower you to see it in those around you."
Poro pushed off from the ladder, hands outstretched for Issei.
"You must listen to me!"
He'd intended to shake him, but tripped over someone's feet. His breath gushed out as he landed on pointed knees.
"Hey, hey, hey!" slaves shouted, and hands seized his arms and legs. "It's too tight to fight in here! Sit down!"
Jerking free, Poro grunted and crawled back to his spot.
"See what I mean," Issei said to the others. "He's mad."
"Yes, I am," Poro said, seething. "But I didn't lay with evil. I raped my family instead." The other slaves and Issei frowned that they didn't understand.
"Captain LeBlanc raped my daughter. She's in the next hold."
A beat passed, then Issei said, "Nice try. Perhaps she's the captain's scorned lover trying to get even."
"Semeta is not his lover, you ignorant wolof!"
This made some of the other Wolof tribesmen glare at him. Poro instantly regretted the slur.
"Fine, do nothing," he said. "We'll die.
But at least we'll be slaves no longer." Issei waved him off.
"Don't listen to him. He has no credibility."
But in the quiet that ensued, Poro saw in some faces that he was believed. The fever ravaged Poro all night long, pulling up gouts of bloody vomit. Someone placed a latrine bucket between his knees, but it quickly overflowed, then spilled as the ship heeled before a mighty wind. He was thankful to still be alive in the morning, and for the starvation pangs to return. As the hatch opened, a slave stared at him in the light.
"Your eyes are yellow, Poro."
Somehow he made it up the ladder, but sprawled on the deck as the ocean rocked the boat. More storm clouds had formed since yesterday. They bruised the sky nearly to the horizon, where they subsided for a golden band of sunlight. He stumbled to the rice pots, but they were empty except for a scoured scum that crawled with bugs. Stomach twisting, Poro headed for a water barrel. A sailor there scooped him a coconut shell of liquid and flicked away the algae before handing it to him. With a shaking hand, Poro took it and sipped. Angry yelling whipped his head around. Issei was screaming up at the captain, who stood upon the quarterdeck stage. No, he addressed Semeta by the captain's side. The girl looked aghast as the captain frowned. Over the wind, Poro couldn't make out the words. The captain asked her something, but she ignored him and argued with Issei. LeBlanc shook her shoulder. Still no response.
Poro!" Captain LeBlanc yelled.
A sailor grabbed Poro's elbow and dragged him over to stand by Issei.
"Translate!"
LeBlanc ordered.
"Father, that man is betraying you!"
Issei sneered at him.
"I'm telling the captain about your lies."
"But why, you fool?"
"What's he saying? Speak!"
Revolted, Poro sighed with the back of his throat. To LeBlanc, he said, "Issei accepted the job as your informer, didn't he?" The captain seemed surprised for a moment, but then he relaxed and lightly put a hand on Semeta's back.
"Issei may not have the capital 9 tails, but he has good sense. Now, tell me what he say, or I slit your daughter's throat."
The hand suddenly snaked under Semeta's chin, and he yanked her head back. Poro stepped forward as if to climb up to him, but LeBlanc warningly placed his knife against her skin. Sudden clarity popped through Poro's fevered thoughts. He realized that if he talked, LeBlanc would assuredly kill her. He searched for something to say, thankful Issei didn't know a word of French. But Semeta, still just a child despite her formidable intellect, screamed into the captain's face.
"Murderer! I told Father what you're planning, and he won't let you get away with it!"
Within a quarter hour, all the surviving male slaves assembled on deck. They gawked at Poro, who was now stripped naked and being restrained by a sailor at the foot of the quarterdeck stage. Issei stood to the side, his arms crossed smugly. In his usual spot above them, Captain LeBlanc kept his arm around Poro's daughter, who now wore wrist shackles. Those sailors not watching the slaves, and there weren't many left of either group, frantically climbed the rigging to lower the sails. The storm that had been gathering for days was nearly upon them. An officer barked commands at the crewmen, telling them to get the cannonballs out of their asses. Heedless of the activity, Captain LeBlanc staggered as the ship swayed like a drunkard. Over the officer's voice, he shouted,
"You are here to witness this last punishment for conspiracy to mutiny!"
Then to Semeta,
"Translate that! Now!"
She spat at him.
"Do it, or your father's sentence shall be death."
"No, Semeta," Poro said. "I'm already dead."
The pretty face twisted in anguish. Then, relenting, she obeyed the order. Smiling, LeBlanc said,
"The conspiracy's leader shall now be punished for telling a perverted lie."
"The captain says it's a lie," Semeta translated to the slaves.
"Very well,"
the captain said, and drew his cutlass. The hand resting on Semeta's back thrust her forward, making her bow over the edge, and in a movement too quick to follow, he decapitated her. Semeta's head fell to the main deck, bounced, and came to rest at Poro's feet. He stared in shock, his breath halting in his throat. Semeta's eyes blinked once, twice.
"No," Issei said. "I wouldn't have helped if I knew you'd do this!"
He jumped up the ladder to reach the captain, but the officer at the top had a sidearm. Aiming down the rungs, he shot Issei's face at point-blank range. The slave fell to the main deck amid smoke and a shower of red bone. Poro sank to his knees, kneeling over his daughter's severed head. The sight of her face, with eyes and mouth open in surprise, tinged the world with unreality.
"Pick it up," the captain said. "Kiss her goodbye."
"No."
"The slaves must see the wages of mutiny. Do as I say, or the jest about the flood in my contractus errance becomes real."
Nothing mattered anymore. Poro picked up his daughter's head and kissed her sweet lips. He recalled Jacobi's belief about souls returning to their homelands. He prayed it was only a superstition, because Jacobi had also said spirits couldn't travel unless their bodies had legs and heads. The storm clouds finally ruptured, and the captain ordered the slaves to return below deck. Poro was the last to go, shivering in the rain as he grieved and held his daughter's head. Blood dripped from the hole beneath her throat, and rain washed it into the floorboards.
"Let's go," a sailor said, and hoisted him under the armpits.
Semeta's head slipped from Poro's hands and skittered across the deck. He tried to go after it, but the sailor shoved him toward the hatch. As Poro mounted the ladder and started down, the captain called to the sailor.
"Crewmen, plug all the breathing holes below decks and stack tops on the hatches. We don't want the ship to swamp in the rain."
Poro gasped and looked up just as the hatch closed on him. It smashed his head and sent him plummeting to the bottom. The three slaves he landed on screamed in pain. For the next hour, but time was difficult to judge in pitch blackness. The storm lashed the ship more severely than any captain had ever punished his crew. Poro, crazed with fever, swiftly forgot the matter about the breathing holes. Instead, he felt the tears on his cheeks and asked if his face was melting.
I can't see you, Poro. I don't know.
His starvation pangs persisted despite more vomiting, which in fact made them worse. How could he be hungry with Sameta dead? The stifling atmosphere, already viscous with used air, steadily thickened. From the bowels of the cramped shelves he and Jacoby had first occupied, hundreds of gasps crescendoed until panic ignited. I can't breathe! Poro, open the hatch! Too late, Poro remembered the captain's order to the crewman. He struggled to climb the ladder, but wasn't fast enough. Someone clawed him off the rungs and started up. Poro landed in fetid darkness, a blind chaos of slaves' bony limbs. The latrine bucket, long since spilled, bounced noisily off his shoulder as the ship heeled over. They pounded the hatch. It won't open! Whole minutes passed in which bodies trampled him in their efforts to escape. 2-3 slaves lay atop his still naked body, fighting for the ladder. Someone erupted with diarrhea into Poro's face. The ship continued to tip under the storm's onslaught. Suddenly, the slaves fell against the far walls. The ship capsized. Poro, near the bulkhead that abruptly became the ceiling, landed on top of the pile of screaming people. Empty barrels crashed past him to splinter apart on jutting heads. Gray light now shone through the cracks around the hatch. The tarp's covering it must have fallen away at the new angle. The ladder, still nailed into the bulkhead, was now 2 horizontal beams. Poro stood on the writhing bodies to reach it. He held it to stay upright as he climbed over the slaves towards the hatch. Why save yourself, or them? She's dead. The hatch still wouldn't open. Poro beat it with his fist, trying to dislodge the bolt or latch or whatever Le Capitaine had used to lock them in. When that didn't work, he hung onto the ladder and kicked. No use. And the wall kicked back. A great tooth of a rock burst through the deck, driving him backwards. Slaves trapped in the pile below shrieked as the reef they'd hit rammed inwards and crushed them. It obliterated the hatch. Poro hung onto the ladder, hauling himself out of the way as the stone chewed past him. Had they finally reached land? The wave that had impaled the ship on the rock moved on, and the tooth withdrew slightly from the hold. It was enough room for the vessel, borne by a strong current and the wind against its body, to start rotating around the obstruction. The ship groaned as they danced. As the opening came to face the other direction, Poro saw the alternate side of the rock. Water poured in through the hole. The ship, now with nothing blocking it, backed away from the reef. Wind, fresh, blasted Poro's face. And a great wave cascaded through the hole. The slave's cries muffled as Poro submerged completely. Drown! I'll drown! He clutched the ladder. Then he was out again. The water fell behind him as sky filled the tear created by the rock. The wave had righted the vessel. Poro dangled from the ladder in astonishment. Beneath him, half-submerged slaves thrashed atop each other like fish in a pond. Some pulled themselves onto the ladder below Poro. He climbed. Snaggletoothed ends of broken deck beams fringed the hole. Splinters punctured Poro's hands as he dragged himself onto the deck. The other slaves grabbed his calves, using him as a ladder. Poro hugged the wood lest they pull him back in. 2 slaves escaped behind him. Getting to their feet, they yelled in triumph as they staggered into the waves and the hungry jaws of Les Rocans. Rain slapped Poro's bare body as he saw that all the sailing masts were gone. Sails and the webbing the crewmen had used to climb them piled in a tangled heap between the main and quarter decks. He looked down at the pool the men's hold had become. Rain splashed the surface, distorting the moving shadows of submerged bodies. If that kept up, the ship would soon sink if it wasn't doing so already. He started to climb. Pulling himself up the mountain of twisted cloth and rope, Poro again asked himself, why? Why struggle? He would die from the fever anyway. With the heat baking his brain, Poro laughed at the absurdity. But he continued climbing. Sameta would have wanted him to. A dead Frenchman, his face as white as the down sail beside him, hung from the gnarled webbing and seemed to wave goodbye. Poro laughed all the harder. As he climbed onto the quarterdeck, waves continued battering the ship like cruel King Kyros kicking a fallen slave. The shape convulsed from this abuse, its death rose huge and endless. And yet all hope wasn't lost. He now saw that the reef the ship had rammed was near the point of a dark shoreline shrouded in rain, perhaps the West Indies or Americas. If these waves continued, which he expected they would, the ship would run aground. And those lights he spied on the beach, were they the torches of men waiting for them? Poro looked back to the quarterdeck. In front of him, a strange wheel upon a type of tree trunk stood defiantly against the storm. A person hugged its base, moaning in the chill wind. Captain LeBlanc. Hatred saturated Poro like the wave now slamming onto the deck. Feeling his strength return, Poro attacked. The captain grunted when Poro jumped on top of him, again choking him. LeBlanc raised his head, revealing an oozing gash across his brow. Growling, he rammed his elbow into Poro's face and sent him sprawling.
So, Poro, come for additional revenge, have we?
The captain was bigger, meaner, and healthier than Poro. His hard boot kicked Poro's stomach with more force than the reef had destroyed the slave hold. Poro's brief surge of energy quickly dissipated. He passed out as LeBlanc picked him up with one hand and pummeled him with the other. When he came to, Poro found himself lying face down upon a pile of coiled rope. He raised his head. The captain had fallen beside him, also face down, and was sputtering in a shallow pool of water. The captain had good balance from his years on sailing ships, despite his limp, but that wasn't helping him in this storm. The captain clutched a pistol loosely in his right hand. Poro went for it, trying to see straight. LeBlanc raised his head as Poro pried the weapon from his wet fingers.
Merde.
Poro aimed the weapon at LeBlanc's nose and groped for the trigger with both hands. But LeBlanc's hand shot out, fingers encircling both of Poro's skinny wrists. He rolled Poro over and straddled him. The captain picked the gun from his hand, then aimed it at Poro's face. He pulled the trigger. The hammer snapped down, but nothing happened. Poro had once seen this happen after a French trader dropped his gun into a cauldron of water.
"The powder was too wet," he'd said.
LeBlanc threw the gun away and drew his knife. He reared back to stab, and a wave splashed over the ship, knocking him off Poro. The knife went flying. Poro dove for it. He got it in time to see LeBlanc lunging for him. As LeBlanc dropped onto him, Poro shoved the knife into the Frenchman's ribs. Screaming, LeBlanc pushed himself off of Poro, who pulled the knife out. As Poro watched, air sucked in through the hole he'd made in LeBlanc's shirt. When LeBlanc exhaled, air and foamy blood spat back out of the wound. Then once more, as rain streamed over him. Suck in, foam out. They lay at the edge of the quarterdeck, the drop-off still draped with one of the fallen sails. The boat jumped, and LeBlanc tumbled down the sheets. "For some mana!" Poro screamed, and still holding the knife, leapt after him. The sloping cloth broke his fall, as it did the captain's, but Poro lost the knife. They came to rest at the mouth of another hole on the deck. LeBlanc tried to speak, but could only cough. Bellowing with rage, Poro tackled him, sending them both into the hole. Children. They broke the men's fall, their tiny bones snapping under the impact. Poro reeled from the screaming, soaked faces. The children cowered against each other in the walls. Some were Sameta's age, but most were younger. The captain had received the worst of it, but he was still alive and coughing. Poro sensed a strange disfigurement in his own ribs, but no matter. Triumphant, he attacked with his teeth. The children hesitated, then joined in. Ah, a decent meal at last.